When it was first suggested to me that I should do a series of four addresses commemorating the 50th anniversary of the formation of the Australian League of Rights, it occurred to me that these talks would be inadequate unless we first went back and examined the roots out of which the Australian League of Rights grew. In other words, it would not be satisfactory to start with the formation of the League of Rights, which was in 1946. The League of Rights grew out of what is called the Social Credit Movement. This movement was first given form and shape at the end of the First World War by C.H. Douglas. C.H. Douglas was a remarkable man who had been engaged by the British government to look into problems with the British aircraft industry during and towards the latter end of the First World War. And he was given the title of Major. That's how he came to be known as Major Douglas. To most people, when they hear about social credit, that conjures up a picture of some type of monetary reform scheme. But that is a complete misrepresentation. Douglas himself, in analysing the finance economic system, made what is beyond doubt a major discovery. Now, please note, I stress that, a discovery. He didn't set out to produce a new economic theory. What he discovered, which we'll look at a little later, was that in the course of production, the financial costs in production were always running ahead of the amount of purchasing power distributed to buy that production. And that had tremendous implications because it meant that the only way the economic system could be maintained under orthodox rules was more and more production, whether we needed it or not. It meant under orthodox finance, it meant increasing debt, and it meant all the type of social problems that are associated with debt. Douglas initially thought all he had to do was to take his discovery to men of importance, key people in society, and they would see the implications of this and thank him very much. Now, his first major discovery was that there were certain groups of people who understood well this deficiency he had discovered, but also they also had grasped how it could be exploited to extend centralized power over the individual. So as you start to look at Douglas, particularly his first book, Economic Democracy, which appeared just after the First World War, and as you read through it, only 25,000 words, you find that the subject of finance is not dealt with in any great detail. What he was concerned about was the more basic problem of the relationship of the individual to the group, or the individual and his institutions, and how the individual was going to control those institutions. And so, right at the beginning, we read that Douglas clearly accepted the traditional Christian view, without spelling it out, when he said that systems were made for men and not men for systems. And the interest of man, which is self-development, is above all systems, whether theological, political, or economic. So Douglas was concerned with this more basic problem, which we will be discussing in this series of talks about the League of Rights, the question of centralization of power and how it affects the individual, and what, if anything, the individual can do about it. Naturally, Douglas's revelation resulted in the development of a movement. A number of journals appeared. One of the most prestigious of these was The New Age, edited by one of the most outstanding literary editors of the time, A.R. Raj, who was one of the first to perceive here was, beyond doubt, a genius. And he opened the columns of his paper, The New Age. And there was a whole flurry of activity concerning what this man Douglas had discovered. But the great impetus to what is called social credit came with the great disaster which we call the Great Depression, which started late in 1929. Now, as Douglas observed, under orthodox finance, those who operate the system had only one way of trying to correct inflation and associated problems, and that was periodically to have credit restrictions, that in turn producing other disasters. So when we had the Great Depression of the 1929s and early 30s, as a result of a very severe policy of credit restriction, there was a worldwide development of activity mainly concerned not with the basic question that Douglas had initially raised, but the subject of some type of monetary reform. It's that reason, while understandable that that should have taken place, many people missed the main point concerning what social credit was about. That was to come later. During the Great Depression years, right around the English-speaking world, including the United States, a tremendous movement developed concerning this whole subject of money, credit reform, and associated matters. It was during the same period, of course, the Great Depression years, we saw the emergence of naked totalitarian systems, the major one being, first, fascism in Italy, that followed by later what's called Nazism. But the major totalitarian threat to the individual was clearly what was called communism. And so the whole of that period was dominated by this tremendous ferment. And what we've got to grasp is that the only set of proposals offering a solution without totalitarianism, but in fact freeing the individual, was social credit. And it's not without significance that one of the senior members of the Soviet hierarchy was quoted as saying that they knew all about social credit. It was the only movement they were afraid of. In other words, they grasped that social credit offered emancipation for the individual. They grasped the philosophical cleavage quite clearly. As we come through that period of ferment, the 30s, there were a number of events we must just draw attention to. A number of members of parliament were actually elected under the title of social credit, the first of these being a Reverend Carruthers in Tasmania. A number of Labour Party politicians of the day grasped the financial aspects of social credit. One of these being Australia's wartime Prime Minister John Curtin, and many others. It's important to understand this as we continue our story. But in 1935, the world's headlines carried a dramatic piece of news. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, a government calling itself Social Credit had not only been elected, but had been elected with such a massive majority that virtually no opposition was left in the parliament. An event of tremendous significance, 1935. This was followed shortly afterwards by another dramatic event in New Zealand, when a New Zealand Labour government, strongly supported by a very virulent, active social credit movement headed by Michael Savage, came to office. In other words, there was around the English-speaking world a revolt against the use of finance, credit restrictions, to push the individual right down the scale of existence, where you had most awful social and other conditions. In Australia, the social credit idea was also taken up with tremendous vigor, and a grassroots movement developed, and it reached the stage where before the outbreak of the Second World War, it was becoming a major factor in Australian politics, as of course it had become in Canada and in New Zealand. And there's little doubt, to my mind, if war had not intervened, what was taking place would have changed the whole course of history. There would have been an effective and constructive revolt against centralized power exercised through finance. But that was not to be, and there's some reason to suggest that perhaps the Second World War itself was not merely the result of what had taken place in the finance-economic sense, but also was designed to head off any effective revolt that was now gathering momentum, particularly around the English-speaking world, including the United States. So the whole situation then dramatically changed with the declaration of war in 1939-1940. The next development that took place leading up to the formation of the League of Rights was on the Australian scene, and that was at the 1940 federal elections, which was dominated by this grassroots movement concerning financial reform, with many members of the Labour Party itself pressing for it. At the end of that election result, the balance of power in the federal parliament was held virtually by two independents, one being a member of the famous Coles family, Mr. Arthur Coles, and the other a wheat grower from the Mallee, Victoria, Mr. Alec Wilson. Mr. Alec Wilson had at least grasped the financial aspects of social credit. Inside the Labour Party itself, which of course it scored heavily, there were a number of key members supporting social credit, people such as Tasmanian Senator Richard Darcy and many others. Into the situation then emerged a man we've got to just spend a few minutes on as part of our story. His name was Dr. H.V. Evatt, very distinguished in the conventional sense, jurist, a member of the High Court, who'd stepped down from the High Court at the 1940 elections to join the Labour Party openly and to campaign as one of their leading candidates. Immediately after that election, we went through a tumultuous political scene, which ended eventually with the independents deciding we could no longer continue with a coalition government headed by Robert Menzies and the Country Party of that time, and that there was no alternative for the nation but to bring the Labour Party to office. Now, when that took place, immediately Dr. Herbert Vere Evatt assumed a position of great importance. He became the Attorney General. And one of his first clear policy decisions was to change the whole structure of constitutional arrangements in Australia. To put it quite bluntly, he proposed to do what a number of federal governments had attempted to do in the past but never been successful, and that was to concentrate power on a scale we'd never seen before in Australia. You see, under our federal constitution, any such proposal must go to the Australian people, and a majority of people in a majority of states must assent before that can be done. Now, there's only one other way that can be done without consulting the people, and that is if all the states are unanimous in agreeing they will transfer power. So Dr. Evatt set out to sell the idea that after the war, post-war conditions would be so chaotic, the federal government would need an enormous increase of power for what was broadly called post-war planning. So his thrust was to persuade the states to hand the power over. And there's no doubt whatever that he was very successful. Even so-called conservative state governments reluctantly agreed, well, the situation was such that perhaps this had to be done. And right around the nation, he carried all before him until he reached Tasmania. And here's a very interesting piece of history. The Tasmanian Labor government, a very moderate Labor government, in fact, number of them pro-social credit, while they had reluctantly agreed, yes, they should transfer the power, Tasmania had a very conservative upper house. And that upper house took the view that such a vast transfer of power, even allegedly only temporarily, and many cynics did not believe it would be only temporary, should not take place even in the middle of a war without the people being consulted. So the Legislative Council in Tasmania refused to pass the legislation, which meant the Evatt thrust was very badly thwarted. As a result of that, he then was put in the position where he had to go to the people. Now, it was during this period that Dr. Evatt was starting to realize that movement called the Social Credit Movement was not only concerned with monetary reform and credit mechanisms, it was also concerned with this question of centralization of power. So the Social Credit Movement, which was, in terms of numbers that period, quite considerable, found itself in the vanguard of the opposition to what Dr. Evatt was proposing, which I might tell you rather badly upset Dr. Evatt. So much so that first of all he called in Mr. Alec Wilson, the independent. He called in Senator Darcy from Tasmania, who was known to be as sympathetic to the social credit movement, and made the suggestion that these people opposing in wartime his proposal were actually some type of subversives, and he might move against them. In fact, to not put too fine a point on it, he virtually suggested they could all be thrown into jail. Senator Darcy, as he tells the story, said, "Well, Bert, Emmett, I don't think the jails would be big enough to take them all, and I don't think that's the way to go." Emmett then said, "Well, perhaps I could talk to them." And so an event took place of great historic importance. Early in December 1942, a meeting was arranged of social creditors in Sydney, which was addressed by Dr. Emmett. Now, the theme of his address was that he was sympathetic to the subject of monetary reform. The old theme that what was financially possible must be made, or physically possible should be made financially possible, but he said then, this was his sales pitch, often it's not constitutionally possible. And so we will need this vast increase of constitutional power after the war to implement some of the proposals which I'm sympathetic to. Once again, he made little progress with social creditors who, because of their knowledge and background, simply declined to go along with this. He called in a number of leading social creditors and tried to talk to them personally, but made little progress either. So eventually in 1944, Dr. Emmett had to hold a most historic constitutional referendum, which leads up to where we are discussing the Australian League of Rights. At that referendum, again, the social creditors played a major role. In fact, they spearheaded the opposition with their vast knowledge and expertise. So, as history relates, a major setback to what Dr. Emmett proposed, the 1944 referendum. But the drive towards centralized power did not stop there. And so, as the war came towards its conclusion, Dr. Emmett and his supporters continued with the theme, modified their proposal to some extent, and so in 1946, they staged another referendum. Prior to this referendum taking place, I had been invited to make a trip to South Australia under the auspices of South Australian Social Creditors, and a most historic meeting took place at which some of South Australia's leading business, professional and other people were present. The main thrust of my address was that the military conflict was over, but that it not resolved the major problem confronting mankind, which was now emerging in a different form, centralized power. The main protagonist now being in the open, the movement called communism. I dealt with the subject of constitutionalism and associated questions. As a result of that address, a number of quite distinguished South Australians felt this address should be republished, and in view of my obvious, from their point of view, understanding of the subject, having been through this over many years, would I consider coming to South Australia to direct a Vote No campaign. It was generally believed that South Australia was going to be a key state, as we've already indicated. For a referendum to be carried, it must have a majority of electors in a majority of states. And the record suggests that South Australia could be a key state. I readily agreed to do exactly that. And so in South Australia was established what became known as the Vote No campaign. Very interesting group of people. Yes, social creditors like myself, but prominent businessmen, leaders of the community, men like the late Sir Arthur Rymal, many others, along with, remarkably enough, some trade unionists, pastoralists, and others, who, irrespective of their backgrounds, were all agreed on one thing: this latest assault on the Constitution had to be defeated. So the Vote No campaign was designed to do that. Well, history, of course, records that that campaign was successful. But it was during that campaign that an idea which had been developing in my thinking against my social credit background started to take firm shape. And that was, instead, every time there was an assault on the Constitution and the whole framework of our society, we needed a permanent, might call it, watchdog movement. A movement which would set out to educate people, permanently educate them. And of course, at this stage, it was quite clear to me and a few others that what was now emerging was the major threat to mankind in the form of centralized power, namely the communist movement. Therefore, the position confronting social creditors had changed. Not the basic issues hadn't changed, but we did require a change of strategy and of emphasis and of tactics. And for the record, actually this took shape shortly after that Vote No campaign, when I had afternoon tea in a cafe in William Street, Adelaide, with a group of people, all of them social creditors, and outlined my thinking that we needed to carry on from where we now had developed. So it was there this idea was born, but the idea itself had its roots in the social credit movement. In the same way, of course, if you'll study social credit and its philosophy, it had its roots in the Christian concept, which was developed much later as events unfolded. I discussed my thinking with C.H. Douglas and felt that the state of the world had shifted to where we did need a new strategy, new tactics. Quite clearly, the major bulwark to the threatened centralization of power on a global scale under the title of communism was what was left of the old British Empire. And so, therefore, the defense of what was left of the empire and what it stood for needed to be undertaken. And Douglas agreed with that strategy. And so, in 1946, the League of Rights took shape and form. But please note, it's important to stress the roots. The basic roots dealt with the same basic problem that mankind had dealt with for centuries: the threat to the individual by centralized power, the bureaucratic state, and legalism. Nothing had changed except the manifestation of how power was to be used. Therefore, we needed a different strategy, and we needed different tactics in order to deal with this subject. So the League then came into existence as a result of it. But it's important I stress again the roots of the League, the roots out of which it developed. It was simply a question of history that it developed in the way it did in South Australia because of the importance of developments in South Australia in 1946. Plus the fact that it was perceived that because of our experience, the social credit movement, in defeating the 1944 referendum, that we had a great deal to offer. The details of that development will be told in other talks and elsewhere, but the major point is it did emerge out of that period. Interestingly enough, some of the most prominent of industrialists were delighted to have our support in that campaign on that particular issue. But one of them, when I said to him afterwards, when we were in the early stages of forming the League, that could we expect the same sort of financial support, he didn't quite see it that way, and I can still recall his terminology, that could be rather dangerous from our point of view, because you're only a pup at the moment, but you could grow up to be a very, very big bulldog and might start biting the backside out of our pants too. So we don't think perhaps we should be supporting that line of direction. The League was first, as I say, then formally established in South Australia. In fact, formally it was launched at a big public meeting in the Adelaide Town Hall, which was recorded by 5DN. Then it was developed here, of course, in Victoria, which had been my major base. Other states quickly grasped the concept. This was the strategy that social creditors should now be adopting and following. And in a very short period of time, the League of Rights was established in all the major states of Australia. Perhaps it should be related that one of the key figures at that time was a man whose writings have subsequently on constitutionalism come to be well known, the late Mr. Arthur Cresby, who for one period was a Liberal member of the Commonwealth Parliament. Arthur was a contemporary of mine, and he played a major role in establishing the League in Queensland. It needs now to be recorded that in those early stages of the formation of the League, the role of the League as not a numbers movement, but an influential movement was starting to take shape. Because the next major assault on decentralized power came with the declaration by the Chifley government to nationalize the Australian banking system. Dr. Ebbett was again one of the driving forces behind this. And all those people you might loosely call socialists and communists and collectivists. Much to the amazement of many people, the League of Rights quickly adopted a role of opposition the bank nationalization. Here again, we saw that many people had never fully grasped what social credit was about. They thought it was merely a scheme of money reform. True, the banks had been rapacious during the Depression, shown little sympathy, much else, and here's now the League of Rights coming out against nationalisation. Opposition to bank nationalisation was simply a logical development of the philosophy of the League, because Douglas himself had warned that any centralisation of power which resulted in the state and the financial system being amalgamated into one power would be virtually impossible to break. Therefore, opposition to bank nationalisation was not defence of the banks, but it was defence of a principle. And so the League found itself in the extraordinary position at that time of being in the forefront of opposition to bank nationalisation, a movement which, to the superficial, had grown out of some sort of financial reform. And that took some adjusting as far as some people's thinking was concerned. It was during that period that we need to relate that the managing editor of the morning conservative newspaper, The Argus, Errol Knox, was introduced to me by a social creditor and invited me to start contributing to the Argus on these matters. And that caused some type of a stir, and the articles were widely read and discussed. And quite clearly this rang some alarm bells in some parts of the world, because it wasn't long before there was a threat to the Argus to take it over, and eventually it was taken over. And one of the first victims of that takeover was my writings, which were, in fact, my last scheduled series of writings was not only censored, was completely eliminated. But also during that period, we had this other amazing situation where the rank and file of the bankers themselves started to develop a new concept about what social credit was about. And we finished with that, I suppose, amazing situation where I was personally running training courses for the bank officers. And we had that situation where senior bankers were listening with great interest to what we had to say, primarily because they were at risk and they were threatened. We don't need to continue that story completely, because ultimately, as we know, ultimately the banks were virtually nationalized. And as we discuss these questions now today, we've seen the concentration of power on a global scale, amalgamation of banks and financial institutions everywhere. But through all this, the League's growth was constantly being fed by its roots. Constantly the League was going back to its roots. And so the next thing we had to do was, if we were really going to build a movement that was going to produce individuals who could make a contribution as what we call social engineers, we needed training courses. We had to have an orderly, procedural approach. That was what I was developing through the Argus in a series of articles before the Argus was closed down. Which highlights the fact that the human drama is not decided by numbers as such. It's decided by those who've got sufficient knowledge and understanding and also dedication to give direction and offer service when the great majority of people feel events have taken them to a state where they need that service. In other words, like many so-called reform movements, the League was from the beginning a service movement, trying to show people how to solve their problems, and in that way building up its own credibility. And so over the years that did take place, there's no question about it. We developed, for example, on the communist question, the only comprehensive training program which subsequently was taken right around the world. Taken around the world because by this time the League itself was growing around the world. And before I come to the end of this first talk, it should be recorded that I suppose one of the major events was the threat to the old British world with something called the Common Market, which the League of Rights clearly foresaw. And so it was in the early 60s that I went to the United Kingdom, but not only went to the United Kingdom, but took the opportunity of visiting all other parts of the Crown Commonwealth, particularly Canada, across Canada and back to New Zealand before returning to Australia. That was a most historic development where these roots were fed again by that social credit movement where it already had taken shape, such as in Canada and in New Zealand. And so eventually out of that came a League of Rights movement right around the old Crown Commonwealth, defending the basic institutions that held that group of people together, being the constitutional monarchy. And on all these issues, the League found itself at the cutting edge of every campaign that was conducted of any significance. And perhaps the measure of the League's success, as we come to conclusion here, may be judged by the type of opposition it has struck. The opposition itself has clearly indicated it sees the threat of this type of movement, not because of numbers, but simply because of its understanding and because of the fact it is rooted in the philosophy of realism. Now, I think if we can bear that in mind as we proceed with these series of talks on the League, we'll grasp where the League has come from, what has fed the League, what sustains the League, and why the League itself cannot be destroyed unless, of course, you ultimately destroy truth itself.